Welcome to the Deep Dive. This is where we take a source, often a big one, and really unpack it to get you the essential insights.
Make you truly well-informed.
Exactly. And today, wow, we are diving into nuclear power. It's definitely one of those topics hugely talked about, often pretty misunderstood.
Oh, definitely. Sparks passionate debate everywhere.
So our mission today is simple. Cut through that noise. We're using just one really comprehensive source, the Wikipedia article on nuclear power. We'll pull out the key facts, the surprising bits, basically give you a shortcut to understanding it all without getting lost.
Right.
Okay, let's get into it. We're talking about harnessing the energy inside the atom itself. It's quite something.
It really is. And what's so fascinating, I think, is how tangled up nuclear power is with, well, everything, global history, economics, environmental debates. It's not just about the tech.
No, it's way bigger.
It reflects our hopes, our fears, our priorities as a society. So yeah, definitely a deep dive topic. We'll trace it right from the start, those early atomic discoveries, all the way to where we are now and what might be next.
An incredible journey, for sure. And the science, the foundation for it all, it actually came together relatively recently. Fission was discovered in 1938.
Yeah, and almost immediately, by 1939, scientists figured out a self-sustaining chain reaction was possible.
Which led pretty quickly, I guess, to the Manhattan Project during World War II. Focus on weapons, obviously.
Yes. But even then, there was this crucial moment for the peaceful side of things. Chicago Pile 1. That was the world's first human-made reactor.
Right, under the stadium.
Exactly. It went critical, sustained that controlled reaction December 2nd, 1942. A huge proof of concept, really, that we could control this power.
So, born from weapons research, but almost immediately, there's this other path. And the first actual electricity from a reactor, that was Idaho, right? EBR?
That's the one. Wow. December 20th, 1951. Didn't produce much, maybe 100 kilowatts or so.
Tiny.
Tiny by today's standards, yeah. But monumentally important. It showed it could be done.
And people noticed. Eisenhower's big speech, Atoms for Peace, in 53.
That was hugely influential. It really pushed the idea of peaceful uses, led to the Atomic Energy Act in 54, encouraging the private sector to get involved. And you also had the U.S. Navy pushing things forward.
The submarines.
Yep, the USS Nautilus in 1954, powered by the S-1W pressurized water reactor. And that design, it heavily influenced the civilian plans that came later.
Makes sense. Meanwhile, the Soviets weren't waiting around. Obninsk, June 54, first grid-connected plant.
5 megawatts. Then the UK followed suit, Calder Hall in 56. First commercial station, but it was dual purpose.
Electricity and plutonium.
Correct. So initially, there was this rapid growth. Global capacity hit 100 gigawatts by the late 70s. Pretty fast.
But then things started to slow down.
They did. Costs started going up. Regulations changed, there were lawsuits, and kind of ironically, fossil fuel prices were dropping at the same time.
So economically, it just didn't look as good.
In many places, yeah. But then came the 1973 oil crisis.
Ah, that changed everything for some countries.
Absolutely. Countries like France and Japan, heavily reliant on imported oil, they doubled down on nuclear. Mm. France especially, they built 25 plants in just 15 years. An incredible commitment.
And look at them, it was 71% nuclear electricity in 2019?
Something like that, yeah. Still the world leader in terms of share. But it wasn't smooth sailing everywhere. Public opposition really started to build in the U.S. back in the early 60s.
What were the main worries back then?
The familiar ones, really.
Yeah.
Potential accidents, sure, but also worries about weapons proliferation, terrorism, and the big one, what do you do with the waste?
Right. That's always been the question.
And it gained momentum. Mid-70s, it was a major movement. The Wild Plant cancellation in Germany in 75 after big protests, that became a symbol, inspired opposition elsewhere.
And then came Three Mile Island, 1979.
Yeah, IES Level 5. Mm. Not the worst category, technically, and no fatalities, which is crucial, but the psychological impact, huge.
Definitely put the brakes on new construction in a lot of places.
It really did, but nothing compared to Chernobyl in 86.
That was the game changer.
Absolutely. INES level 7, the highest. Mm-hmm. 56 direct deaths, cleanup costs, estimated around $68 billion. It just fundamentally changed everything. Safety became paramount.
That's when WANA was formed, right? The World Association of Nuclear Operators.
Exactly. A direct result. And countries reacted strongly. Italy, for example, phased out nuclear completely in 1990.
Seemed like nuclear might be on the way out for a while there.
It did feel that way.
Yeah.
But then, early 2000s, climate change concerns started getting really serious. CO2 emissions.
And suddenly, nuclear looked like a potential solution again. The nuclear renaissance.
That was the term, yeah. Led to new design. Generation third reactors focus on enhanced safety. But just as that optimism was building.
Fukushima, 2011.
2011.
Triggered by that massive earthquake and tsunami, lost cooling, three core meltdowns. Again, INES level 7.
No direct radiation death, thankfully, but the consequences were still devastating.
Oh, absolutely. Widespread contamination, huge displacement. 50,000 households had to move, food shipment bans. It prompted another wave of rethinking. Germany decided to phase out.
Though Japan itself started restarting reactors after a few years, right? 2015.
Cautiously, yes.
Yeah.
And that brings us more or less to today. The outlook now, it's actually looking more promising again.
Because of climate change, low carbon energy.
That's a huge driver. The global trend seems to be new plants basically balancing out the older ones retiring. As of late 2024, about 415 reactors operating globally.
Wow.
Yeah, 374 gigawatts of capacity, plus 66 under construction, 87 planned. The U.S. still has the biggest fleet in terms of pure output, almost 800 terawatt hours a year. And they run them hard, 92% capacity factor.
Incredible uptime, but France still has the highest percentage.
Yep, 65% of their electricity in 2023. And recent policy moves show renewed interest. Japan decided in 2022 to reopen 10 more plants, push for new designs.
And France is planning new ones too.
Six new reactors announced, right. Partly driven by, you know, rising oil and gas prices, energy security, plus their carbon goals. It's a strategic move away from volatile fossil fuels.
Okay, so that's the history, the sort of roller coaster ride it's been on. How do these places actually work?
Right, the basics. At heart, they're thermal power stations. Just like coal or gas plants, they use heat to make electricity.
But the heat source is different. It's nuclear fission.
Exactly. So you have a few key parts. The nuclear reactor, that's where the fission happens. A cooling system to take away the intense heat generated.
That heat makes steam.
Right, which spins a turbine, converting heat to mechanical energy. And then an electric generator turns that mechanical energy into the electricity we use. Standard stuff, really, after the heat source.
And the fission itself, that chain reaction?
It starts when a neutron hits, typically a uranium-235 or a plutonium nucleus. That nucleus splits, releasing a huge amount of energy. And crucially, more neutrons.
Which then hit other nuclei.
And keep the process going. A self-sustaining chain reaction.
How do they stop it from running away? That sounds potentially dangerous.
Control is absolutely key. And reactor design is clever here. A tiny fraction of those neutrons released are actually delayed by a split second. Doesn't sound like bugs.
It makes a difference.
A huge difference. It gives mechanical systems time to react. Operators use control rods usually made of materials like cadmium or boron that absorb neutrons.
So they can slide those in and out?
Precisely. Slide them in, they soak up neutrons, the reaction slows down, pull them out, the reaction speeds up. It allows for very fine control over the power level.
Okay, makes sense. What about the fuel itself, the whole cycle?
Right, the nuclear fuel cycle. Starts with mining uranium ore. That gets processed and concentrated into what they call yellowcake.
Yellowcake, heard that term.
Then often it needs enrichment. See, natural uranium is mostly uranium-238, which isn't easily fissile. Only about 0.7% is the useful U-235 isotope.
Not enough for most reactors?
For the most common type, light water reactors or LWRs. They need that U-235 concentration boosted, typically to between 3.5 and 5%. That's enrichment.
How do they do that?
Usually with centrifuges these days, spinning uranium hexafluoride gas at incredibly high speeds to separate the isotopes by their tiny mass difference.
Complex stuff.
Very. Once it's enriched, they convert it into uranium oxide powder, press it into small pellets, like ceramic pellets.
Little pellets.
Yeah, about the size of a pencil eraser. Those pellets are then stacked into long tubes, usually made of a zirconium alloy, to form fuel rods. And bundles of these rods make up a fuel assembly ready for the reactor.
And after it's used, it's spent fuel.
Correct. And it's incredibly hot and highly radioactive when it comes out. First stop is the spent fuel pool, basically a big deep pool of water right there at the reactor site.
Cooling.
Cooling and shielding. The water does both. It stays there for, say, 6 to 10 years typically.
And then?
Once it's cooled down enough, it can be moved into dry storage casks. These are massive, incredibly robust containers, usually steel-lined concrete or solid metal, designed for long-term storage and shielding.
And the radioactivity goes down over time.
Significantly.
Yeah.
It decreases exponentially, actually. Mm-hmm. After just 100 years, the radioactivity has dropped by about 99.5%. Still needs careful management, of course, but the initial intense heat and radiation decay quite fast.
Okay. And what about the uranium itself? Is there enough?
Uranium is actually surprisingly common, about 40 times more common than silver in the Earth crust.
Really? Didn't know that.
Yeah. Based on known resources, economically recoverable at prices around, say, $130 per kilogram back in 2011, Estimates were they'd last maybe 70 to 100 years.
Okay, that doesn't sound like that long, globally speaking.
It doesn't, if you only consider current reactor types. Those light water reactors are pretty inefficient, mainly using just that tiny fraction of U-235.
Ah, but there are other options.
Big time. This is where things get interesting. Technologies like reprocessing and advanced fast reactors can utilize the much, much more abundant uranium-238. Remember, that's 99.3% of natural uranium.
So you could unlock way more energy.
Orders of magnitude more. If you factor in U-238 plus uranium from phosphate ore deposits, estimates jump to potentially 160,000 years worth of energy at current consumption rates.
160,000 years? That's staggering.
It really shifts the perspective. And then there's the really out there idea.
Yeah.
Uranium from seawater.
Is there much in the ocean?
An estimated 4.4 billion tons dissolved in seawater. It's constantly replenished by rivers eroding rocks. And it's a big if we could figure out how to extract it economically at scale.
Then nuclear could basically be renewable.
But some argue exactly that. It would fundamentally change the resource equation.
Yeah.
Research is ongoing, but it's technically very challenging and currently expensive.
Okay, fascinating possibilities. But let's talk about the elephant in the room for many people. The waste.
Right. The waste conundrum. It's crucial to distinguish types.
Yeah.
You've got low-level waste, or LLW. Think contaminated gloves, tools, clothing. Relatively low radioactivity, easier to handle.
And then the serious stuff.
High-level waste, HLW. That's primarily the spent nuclear fuel we just talked about. Very radioactive, needs careful long-term management.
What's actually in spent fuel?
From a typical light water reactor, it's about 95% uranium, mostly U-238, some leftover U-235. Then about 4% are fission products, things like strontium-90, cesium-137. These are intensely radioactive initially, but decay relatively quickly, responsible for most of the short-term heat and radiation.
And the last 1%.
That's the tricky part. Transuranic actinides, plutonium, americium, neptunium. These elements have very long half-lives, thousands or hundreds of thousands of years. They're responsible for the long-term radioactivity challenge.
So they stick around for ages.
They do. Though, interestingly, after about 100,000 years, the overall radioactivity of the spent fuel actually drops below that of the natural uranium ore it originally came from.
Huh. Okay. So what are we doing with it now? You mentioned interim storage.
Yeah. Currently, most spent fuel is stored right where it was generated, at the reactor sites. First in those pools, then in the dry casks. There are over 430 locations worldwide with this kind of interim storage.
But that's not the final answer, right?
No. The international scientific consensus is clear. The preferred long-term solution is deep geological disposal, burying it deep underground in stable rock formations.
Like Yucca Mountain in the U.S. was supposed to be.
Exactly, though that project stalled for political reasons. Right now, there are no commercial-scale, operational, deep repositories for high-level waste anywhere in the world. Finland's Onkalo facility is the furthest along. It's under construction now.
So we have a plan, but haven't fully implemented it yet.
That's a fair summary. It's worth mentioning, though, the natural reactors at Oklo in Gabon.
Yeah.
Nature actually ran nuclear reactors 2 billion years ago.
What? Really?
Yeah. And the waste products from those natural reactors stayed contained within the rock formations for billions of years. It shows that geological isolation can work over immense timescales.
Wow. Okay, perspective is key here. How much waste are we actually talking about compared to other industries?
This is where it gets really interesting and often counterintuitive. In countries with nuclear power, nuclear waste accounts for less than 1% of all the industrial toxic waste generated. Less than 1%.
That seems low.
It is, especially by volume.
Uh-huh.
Nuclear power produces vastly less physical waste compared to fossil fuels. Think about coal ash.
Right. You see those huge ash ponds sometimes.
Exactly. Coal plants produce enormous volumes of ash, which contains heavy metals like arsenic, mercury, lead, and it's also mildly radioactive. Because coal contains trace amounts of uranium and thorium.
So coal plants release radioactivity, too.
They do. Studies consistently show that through fly ash released into the air and leaching from ash ponds, coal power actually releases over 100 times more radioactivity into the environment than a nuclear power plant does during normal operation.
100 times more. That's wild.
It is. It really challenges perceptions. Here's another example. Yankee Row plant in the U.S., generated power for decades, 44 billion kilowatt hours. Its entire inventory of spent fuel fits into just 16 dry casks.
16 casks for its whole lifetime.
Yep. Or think about it personally. Your entire lifetime's electricity needs, if generated by a nuclear power, would produce a volume of high-level waste about the size of a soda can.
A soda can. Okay, that really puts the volume in perspective.
It does. And that brings us to ways to potentially shrink that volume even further and get more energy out. Reprocessing and breeding.
What's reprocessing?
It's chemically separating the spent fuel. You can extract the unused uranium, mostly U-238, and the plutonium that was created in the reactor. Up to 95% of the spent fuel mass can potentially be recycled.
Recycled into new fuel.
Exactly. They make what's called mixed oxide fuel, or MOX fuel, using the plutonium mixed with uranium. This increases sustainability, gets more energy from the original uranium, and reduces the volume of the final high-level waste that needs a disposal.
Sounds good. I need downsides.
Well, it doesn't significantly reduce the short-term radioactivity, and it's currently more expensive than just using fresh uranium fuel and storing the spent fuel directly. Plus, separating plutonium raises proliferation concerns.
Ah, because plutonium can be used in weapons.
Right. So it's done commercially in places like France, UK, Russia, Japan, India.
Yeah.
But the U.S., for policy reasons largely tied to proliferation concerns, decided against commercial reprocessing back in the 70s.
Okay. And breeding, what's that?
Breeding is even more advanced. It's designing a reactor specifically to convert non-fissile material like that abundant uranium-238 or even thorium into new fissile fuel while the reactor is operating.
So it makes more fuel than it consumes?
Potentially, yes. Or at least converts fertile material into usable fuel very efficiently. Fast breeder reactors, which use fast-moving neutrons, are particularly interesting because they can actually burn up those long-lived actinides, the most problematic part of nuclear waste.
So they could reduce the long-term hazard and create fuel.
That's the promise. They essentially turn waste into fuel while generating power. Russia has commercial fast breeder reactors operating, like the BN-800. India and China are actively building them too.
So this raises a big question. If reprocessing can reduce waste volume and breeding can burn the nasty stuff and make new fuel, why aren't these technologies more widespread?
That is the critical question, isn't it? It really gets to the heart of the complexity.
What are the barriers then? Is it just cost? Or the proliferation thing?
It's a mix. Definitely high upfront costs for building reprocessing plants or advanced reactors. The proliferation risk associated with separated plutonium is a major political and security factor for many countries. And, frankly, national energy policies differ. Some prioritize closing the fuel cycle. Others find direct disposal of spent fuel simpler or currently cheaper, given uranium prices.
So not just technical, it's economic, political, strategic.
Exactly. A complex web of factors. Which leads us neatly into the broader discussion of safety, security, and those proliferation risks.
Right. What makes nuclear safety such a focus? What are the inherent challenges?
There are a few key things. One, obviously the materials inside the reactor core are intensely radioactive. Two, decay heat. Even when you shut down the fission chain reaction, the radioactive byproducts continue decaying and generating significant heat for a long time. That heat must be removed, or the fuel can overheat and melt.
Like what happened at Fukushima and Three Mile Island. Loss of cooling.
Precisely. Loss of cooling is a major failure scenario. And third, there's the theoretical risk, however small in modern designs, of a criticality accident and uncontrolled power surge.
So how do modern plans guard against these?
Multiple layers of safety. Modern reactors have what's called a negative void coefficient of reactivity. Basically, if the reactor gets too hot or too much steam forms, the fission reaction naturally slows down. It's a passive safety feature.
Sort of self-regulating.
In a way, yes. Then you have the active systems, the control rods for rapid shutdown, and crucially, emergency core cooling systems, ECCS, multiple redundant systems designed solely to pump coolant into the core and remove that decay heat if the primary cooling fails.
And the big concrete domes we see.
The containment building, that's the final major physical barrier designed to withstand huge pressures and contain any potential release of radioactive material in a severe accident. Multiple barriers are key fuel cladding, reactor vessel, containment building.
Okay. Now, here's a stat that always surprises me when I see it. The actual death rate.
Yes. This is where the data really challenges perception. When you look at deaths per unit of energy produced per terawatt hour of nuclear power, it comes out incredibly low. About 0.03 deaths per TWH.
Making it.
The second safest major energy source, statistically speaking, right behind solar. Safer than coal, oil, natural gas, even hydropower, when you account for accidents. And crucially, air pollution.
Air pollution deaths are a big factor for fossil fuels.
Huge. One study estimated that nuclear power, just by displacing fossil fuels, prevented something like 1.84 million air pollution-related deaths between 1971 and 2009 alone.
That's a massive number.
It is. Now, that doesn't diminish the very real human cost and trauma of major accidents when they do happen. The forced evacuations, the long-term displacement, the mental health impacts, the fear of radiation, radiophobia, those are significant social consequences, absolutely clear from Chernobyl and Fukushima.
And those major accidents, they stick in the public mind. Kishtim, Windscale, SL1, Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, Fukushima.
They do. And the economic costs are staggering. Chernobyl's cleanup, estimated $68 billion. Fukushima, maybe $187 billion or more.
Who pays for that? Isn't there a special insurance setup?
Yes. Nuclear power operates under international conventions, like the Price-Anderson Act in the U.S., that limit the liability of plant operators in a major accident, with governments effectively providing a backstop beyond a certain level. It's controversial.
Because it looks like a subsidy.
Critics argue it is, shielding the industry from the true potential costs. Though proponents point out other large-scale infrastructure isn't always fully insured against catastrophe either. Think about massive dam failures, like the Banquao Dam collapse in China. The risk often exceeds what private insurance markets can cover.
Interesting comparison. Okay, what about deliberate threats? Terrorism, security.
Definitely a concern. Nuclear plants and spent fuel storage sites contain materials that could be targets. The 9/11 Commission report specifically mentioned this risk.
So security must be intense.
Extremely. In the U.S., for example, they have multiple layers. Robust physical barriers, intrusion detection, heavily armed guard forces, strict access controls. They even run simulated attacks called force-on-force exercises to test defenses.
What about threats from the inside?
Insider sabotage is also a recognized risk. There was a fire at the Indian Point plant in the U.S. in 1971. There was actually arson committed by a plant employee. So vetting and monitoring personnel is crucial, too.
And then there's the proliferation risk we touched on, the weapons connection.
Right. The dual-use nature of some nuclear technologies, particularly enrichment and reprocessing, means they could potentially be diverted to produce fissile materials for nuclear weapons. That's the core concern with national programs like Iran's, and why international oversight through the IAEA and treaties like the Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT, are so important.
Trying to keep the peaceful and military uses separate.
Exactly. But there's a fascinating flip side to this, too, the Megatons to Megawatts program.
What was
a landmark agreement between the U.S. and Russia after the Cold War? They took highly enriched uranium weapons-grade stuff from dismantled Soviet nuclear warheads, blended it down to low-enriched uranium suitable for reactor fuel, and the U.S. bought it to generate electricity.
Turning bombs into electricity.
Literally. It eliminated the equivalent of something like 10,000 nuclear warheads. For nearly two decades, about 10% of all electricity in the United States was generated using fuel from former Soviet bombs. An incredible non-proliferation success story.
Wow. Why'd it end?
The original agreement ran its course. Russia apparently isn't keen to extend it unless there's more market demand for the fissile material itself. But it shows how the civilian side can contribute to disarmament.
Okay, that leads us right into the environmental picture and the big debate. Where does nuclear fit in the climate change fight?
This is probably the central argument for nuclear power today. In terms of carbon emissions, it's a powerhouse of low carbon generation.
Oh, low, we're talking.
Life cycle emissions, so including mining, construction, operation, decommissioning. The IPCC median estimate is around 12 grams of CO2 equivalent per kilowatt hour.
How does that compare?
It's incredibly low, comparable to wind and solar, maybe even lower than some solar, depending on manufacturing. Mm. Compare that to coal at 820 grams or natural gas at 490 grams. It's a stark difference.
And the cumulative impact.
Huge. Estimates suggest nuclear power has avoided something like 72 billion tons of CO2 emissions since 1970, compared to if that electricity had come from coal.
Okay, so very low carbon. What about radiation release during normal operation?
Also extremely low. We're all exposed to natural background radiation all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Average is about 2.4 millisieverts per year globally. Public exposure from living near an operating nuclear plant, it's minuscule. Globally averaged, about 0.00002 millisieverts per year. Locally, even less.
Less than background.
Far, far less. Interestingly, as we mentioned, living near a coal plant actually exposes you to slightly more radiation dose, about 0.00003 millisieverts per year, because of the radioactive elements in coal ash.
Okay, so low carbon, low routine radiation. This shapes the debate then. Let's break down the arguments. Pro-nuclear first.
Proponents really emphasize it as a sustainable, reliable baseload energy source. Key for reducing carbon emissions and improving energy security, reducing reliance on imported fossil fuels.
And the health benefits of avoiding air pollution.
That's a major point, citing those millions of estimated deaths prevented by displacing coal and gas. They also highlight the low volume of waste, arguing it can be safely managed long-term or potentially reduced and recycled through reprocessing and breeding.
And safety.
They point to that very low operational death rate per TWH, describing the safety record as unparalleled among major energy sources despite the high-profile accidents. Economically, they often argue that levelized cost of electricity, LCOE analyses, show nuclear is competitive, especially when you value its 247 reliability, something intermittent renewables need storage or backup for. Least cost dispatchable low carbon option is the argument.
Okay. Now the anti-nuclear arguments, what are their main points?
Concerns center on the inherent risks. Accidents, however rare, have massive consequences. The unresolved long-term waste disposal issue is huge for opponents. Proliferation risks, the potential for terrorist attacks. They argue these outweigh the benefits.
And cost.
A major focus. High upfront construction costs $6 to $9 billion for a new large reactor, often needing significant government subsidies or loan guarantees. They point to the huge, often state-borne costs of cleaning up accidents like Chernobyl and Fukushima. And projected future costs for waste management are enormous, maybe $250 billion, just for existing EU waste by 2050.
What about the speed? Can we build it fast enough for climate change?
That's another key criticism. Construction times are long median, with somewhere between 7 and 11 years recently. Critics say that's simply too slow given the urgency of decarbonizing. Renewables like wind and solar could be deployed much faster, they argue.
And new reactor designs.
Opponents often view them as unproven, potentially riskier because they're less tested, and still years away from commercial reality. A distraction, they might say, from scaling up renewables now. They also argue LCOE figures often hide the true costs and risks not covered by private insurance.
So it boils down to a fundamental disagreement on the best path.
Very much so. Some analyses suggest 100% renewable grids are feasible and the preferable route, avoiding nuclear risks entirely.
How does land use compare, though? That's often brought up.
That's a strong point for nuclear. It's incredibly land efficient. To get the same annual electricity output, a nuclear plant might need about 1.3 square miles. Solar PV could need 60 square miles, and wind farms potentially over 300 square miles, including buffer zones.
That's a massive difference.
Huge difference, especially if you're talking about powering dense population centers or countries with limited land. Proponents also point to history. France and Sweden decarbonized their grids rapidly, largely with nuclear, in about a decade. They argue nuclear can displace fossil fuels quickly.
Whereas opponents emphasize the speed and falling costs of solar and wind deployment happening now.
Exactly. It's a debate about speed, cost, risk, land use, and the fundamental waste challenge. Can we be sure about containing waste safely for hundreds of thousands of years? Although, as mentioned, bodies like the EU's Joint Research Center do conclude the geological disposal technology itself is sound and available.
So much to weigh up. What about the future, beyond current reactors?
There's a lot of research into advanced designs. Current reactors are mostly Gen the second or Gen the third. The focus is on generation of fourth.
What makes Gen the fourth different?
The goals are broad. Improved economics, even higher safety standards, better proliferation resistance, much more efficient use of uranium resources, and crucially, the potential to consume existing nuclear waste, particularly those long-lived actinides.
Closing the fuel cycle, essentially.
That's the idea. Commercial deployment is likely post-2030, but they represent a potential paradigm shift.
Any other futuristic concepts?
There's hybrid fusion fission, combining elements of both processes.
How would that work?
The idea is to use neutrons from a fusion reaction to drive a subcritical fission assembly containing nuclear waste. The potential is to burn up almost all the remaining energy in spent fuel, drastically cut waste volume, and transmute those hazardous actinides into shorter-lived isotopes.
Sounds amazing. Why isn't it happening?
Well, fusion itself is still experimental. But interest in these hybrid ideas has actually grown a bit recently, partly because pure fusion power is taking so long.
Ah, fusion. The ultimate dream for many.
The long-term promise, yes. Potentially even safer than fission, producing much less long-lived radioactive waste. But it's been 30 years away for about 70 years now.
Still incredibly difficult technically.
Immensely. Controlling plasma at hundreds of millions of degrees. Mm. But progress is being made. ITER in France is the huge international effort, aiming to demonstrate sustained fusion with net energy gain. It's faced delays. Maybe operations start around 2027 now.
But commercial power is still decades off.
Realistically, probably not before 2050, based on most projections. Although there's also a surge in private fusion startups now, getting significant investment. The U.S. Department of Energy just gave $46 million to 8 firms in 2023, aiming for pilot plants within a decade. So there's renewed optimism and push.
Okay. We've covered a massive amount of ground here. The history, the tech, the waste, safety, the fierce debates, the future. It's incredibly complex.
It really is. No easy answers.
Which leads us to the final thought for you, our listener. Considering everything we've unpacked in this deep dive, the triumphs, the tragedies, the science, the stats, the arguments, what role do you think nuclear power should ultimately play as we try to build a sustainable and secure energy future? What trade-offs, when it comes down to it, are we truly willing to make to power our world?